Feel like I'm retro. This is the Soul Matters month where we're supposed to be the people of memory, but I went and found last year's people of hope because that's what was resonating for me. So you may have heard it a year ago, but this is a refresher. It starts with a quote from a theologian, Jorgen Moltmann. Faith, whenever it develops into hope, causes not rest, but unrest. Not patience, but impatience. It does not calm the unquiet heart, but is itself this unquiet heart in all of us. Those who hope can no longer put up with the reality as it is, but begin to suffer under it, to contradict it. True hope means conflict with the world for the good of the promised future stabs inexorably into the flesh of every unfulfilled present. And then the guide says, it's not easy to hear well this time of year, especially when it comes to hope. The dominant message is about hope offering us calm. The light will come. A new day is on its way. Justice and joy are growing in the womb and will soon be born. Hope, from this point of view, is a voice that reassures. It's a welcomed whisper that says, yes, the sky may be dark now. Yes, the road you're on at this moment may be hard, but trust me, over that horizon, a new world is waiting for us all. This soothing message comes to us as a gift. During dark days, we all get tired. The fruits of our efforts are hard to see. We are alone. We feel alone. The promise these things will change offers us relief. And we are released from the burden of believing it's all up to me or this all must be solved now. It's a beautiful and needed message, but as Moltmann and others remind us, it's only half of what hope is trying to say. Hope doesn't just whisper, it will be different. It shouts, it should be different. And it can be different. Yes, it speaks soothing and trusting and waiting, but it also takes the form of holy impatience that declares, enough is enough, the time is now. Thank you, Bill. As Moltmann puts it, hope is not just that which calms the unquiet heart. It is the unquiet heart. In other words, hope doesn't just promise us that change will come in the future, it also changes who we are in the present. When we believe a new day is dawning, we don't just sit down and wait. We get up and look to meet the light. When hope convinces us that there are unseen forces working for good, we begin to look around more closely. And in doing so, we notice that darkness and pain are not all that it is. When hope's only holy impatience gets into our bones, we start acting as if we deserve a new day now, which in turn changes others by convincing them we have all waited long enough. So I've been thinking a good deal about hope lately. Though is traditionally a term used in religious or therapeutic circles, lately my worlds have been colliding. For those of you who don't know me, I run a free clinic during the day. So healthcare has suddenly realized the power and potency of hope. And I feel like my two worlds are colliding in having hope conversations in a healthcare setting. Some of you may have heard or read or watched movies or read blogs or heard podcasts or articles about the science of hope. And I find it truly fascinating that scientists finally caught up with what religious thinkers have known for millennia. That hope really matters a great deal in our life and our living. So briefly, just because I've opened this can of worms, The science behind HOPE stems from a massive research project into trauma, specifically childhood trauma, known as adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. And once researchers identified ACEs and their impact upon health, including dramatically increased probability of chronic disease and early death, and shockingly, changes to our very DNA, so we pass along those chronic conditions to our progeny. Once they identified ACEs, then they had to find a countervailing force to the trauma. And they discovered HOPE. Mostly, they use the term in the science literature of resiliency, but they're really talking about HOPE. And resiliency, there's a nice little graphic that I couldn't figure out how to do because we don't do PowerPoints. But it's almost like the balance beam. Resiliency is those inner and outer resources that enable us to survive trauma. So if you think about trauma weighing down one side, the resiliency factors that each of us have are what help it balance so that the trauma doesn't send us off the edge. Discussions about trauma and HOPE have become quite common in the medical world, so much so that I've sat in conversation with physicians and healthcare administrators who talk wistfully about writing a prescription for HOPE. Not for drugs, but for HOPE. And that such a prescription would cure many of us of that which ails us. And at the clinics, at the free clinics, we are deeply engaged with this work. Our patients typically have high ACEs scores with significant trauma in their lives. And much of our work is focused on building resiliency and offering hope. And it matters. Hope is life-changing for our most vulnerable patients. We see it in their health outcomes, their social outcomes like housing and employment, their very being and presence. We photograph our patients as part of their medical record, and we have had to repeat photos for many of our patients because they changed so dramatically that they were no longer recognizable. That is the power of hope. But what makes this a sermon? See, what's the relevance for us sitting here today who may or may not have personal histories replete with trauma? A starting point for me is our understanding of hope. Personally, Emily Dickinson's definition has always resonated with me, that hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings tunes without words and never stops. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings tunes without words and never stops. One of the scientists involved in all that research defines hope as the belief that the future will be better than the present, along with the belief that you have the power to make it so. So he pairs hopeful thinking with a sense of personal agency, that we have the power to act to improve our lives. And from The Soul Matters, the theologian Jorgen Moltmann writes, faith, whenever it develops into hope, causes not rest but unrest, not patience but impatience. It does not calm the unquiet heart, but is itself the unquiet heart in all of us. Those who hope can no longer put up with reality as it is, but begin to suffer under it, to contradict it. True hope means conflict with the world, for the goad of the promised future stabs exorbitantly into the flesh of every unfulfilled present. Each of these statements offers a different understanding, a different nuance, if you will. One, poetic, emphasizes the spiritual nature of hope and the resilience, never giving up, never stopping that song. One, pairing hopeful thinking with that sense of personal agency. And one claiming that true hope is conflict with the world as it is. Personally, I find truth in each, and find each of them useful in different circumstances. On those days that are hard, where I'm facing challenges and I don't want to get out of bed, You know those days. Emily Dickinson's Thing with Feathers comforts me. When I need that extra oomph to motivate me to finish that project, to finish that hard task, I resonate with the sense of personal agency. And when I feel out of sorts with the world as it is today, so much of the time, I find solace in the understanding that my out of sortness is hope. For me, hope and faith and soul are deeply intertwined. I don't think you can talk about one without the other. Scientists try to, but I don't think you can. My personal theology and faith gives rise to my sense of hope, which lives in my soul. In a discussion with my brother this weekend about today's reflection, he posited very firmly, and my brother is a huge young man. He can drop a quarter through his wedding ring. So when he's firm, you kind of go, okay, you said so. 6'3", big, huge. But he said, and he's a retired military, he said, you can't have faith, hope without faith, and quoted the line about there's no atheists in foxholes. It's very firm. We discussed. And as much as he and I tend to debate most things, I found that I agreed with him this day. It was rare. We marked it down in the journal. See, whether one puts their faith in God or nature or humanity or community, whether one is Jewish or Muslim or pagan or Christian or Hindu or Buddhist or humanist, we each place our faith in something. Even those who are agnostic or atheist have a faith system. And on the liturgical calendar, because we are in church, we are entering that season of hope. Both Christian Advent and Jewish Hanukkah start next week. Both are traditions of hope. Advent is that time of living in the tension between past and future, between already and not yet, with hope for our vision of love and justice, with Jesus, which Jesus taught. Hanukkah celebrates hope realized, that in rededicating the temple, though there was only supposed to be enough oil for one day, it lasted for eight. So during this time in the liturgical year, our thoughts turn naturally to hope. But from whence comes the resiliency of hope? Because each of us has encountered people in our lives who are truly hopeless, who have given up. The quality that best describes a hopeless person to me is lightless. Lightless. No light in the eyes, no light in the spirit, just an emptiness of light. It's not a place I ever want to be, no matter what unknown challenges are before me or you. So how do we hold on to hope? How do we make sure that it is resilient in our lives to enable us to face whatever may come? What is that hope that gets us out of bed on the bleakest days, that enables us to keep putting one foot in front of the other, even though the path is hidden and rocky and challenging? Or that motivates that caravan of asylum seekers walking from Central America? Hope for me is a very human emotion. It arises from our uniquely human cocktail of soul and faith and connection. We humans require connection. It is intrinsic to our being, from birth until death. And there's lots of science about lack of connection and what it does. We need connection. And we humans have always found something in which to believe. One of my favorite writers, historian of religion, Karen Armstrong, writes, "My study of the history of religion has revealed that human beings are spiritual beings. Indeed, there is a case for arguing that Homo sapiens is also Homo religios. Men and women started to worship gods as soon as they became recognizably human. They created religions at the same time they created the first works of art. This was not simply because they wanted to propitiate powerful forces. These early phases expressed the wonder and mystery that always seemed to be an essential component of the human experience of this beautiful yet terrifying world. Like art, religion has been an attempt to find meaning and value in life despite the suffering the flesh is heir to. Like any other human activity, religion can be abused, but it seems to have been something that we have always done. It was not tacked on onto a primordially secular nature by manipulative kings or priests, but was natural to humanity," says Armstrong. "And most humans, as a dimension of faith, hold on to a belief of a spirit self or a soul, some dimension of self that will live beyond the corporeal body. Whether Buddhist or Hindu, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, pagan, and orientation. Most humans understand that we are more than our body. The hope, the soul, I argue, is the home of hope." And Dickinson resonates with that. "So how do we nurture hope's resiliency? How do we ensure that our hope is strong and that our resources are more than sufficient to face the challenges of now and those yet unknown? What can we do to make sure we do not fall into that place of lightless hopelessness?" I suggest three things. We tend to our soul. We find quiet time for meditation to still the monkey mind and hear our soul's whispering. Whether we engage in sitting, walking, dishwashing, hiking, or some other form of meditation. The important dimension is to quiet the busyness of our minds from the day-to-day reality and to listen to the quiet voice within. Like any relationship, our relationship with our soul requires attention and attentive listening and nurture. And as spiritual and hopeful self-care, we need to make time for our souls. And second, we nurture our belief system, whatever it may be. And perhaps that's an odd suggestion to many of you. I can see some curiosity about how exactly one nurtures a belief system. I mean, explore your beliefs, reflect upon them, dialogue with them, ask questions of them, find a deeper understanding. No matter what we believe, there are always deeper dimensions to discover, new questions to ask, new things to learn. But most significant to the resilience of hope is connection. Getting and staying connected with our support network, building deep, lasting, loving, and trusting ties during good times so that they sustain us during challenge. We all know how easy it is to want to isolate during times of challenge. It's almost second nature to want to hide in bed and pull the covers over your head or run away from life or feel so embarrassed, ashamed, humiliated, vulnerable to reach out for help when we need it most. But connection is the fundamental key to our resiliency, to hope's resiliency. I know this from personal experience, and likely you do too, that in those moments of challenge, when we succumb to the temptation to isolate, We're really good at making ourselves feel worse. And digging deeper into that hole. But remember also that magical, almost magical change that happened when someone we cared about finally did connect. And how it changed our whole feeling and being. But now that scientists have discovered hope, we actually have something more than personal experience to rely upon. Returning to the ACEs study and the Common Companion Resilience study, 8 of the 14 factors that scientists have identified about resilience are about connection. Over 60%, according to scientists, of what makes us able to deal with trauma and challenge is connection with those who care about us. And because working with folks who experience a great deal of trauma can lead to secondary trauma among caregivers, our clinics team is engaged in what's known as trauma-informed care training. And in this training, the most important dimension and protective factor for caregivers is connection with your team. Science has finally validated what we in the religious community have known all along, that connection matters to our being, to our sense of hope, to our sense of resiliency. That hope is resilient when we are connected. And while physicians and healthcare administrators may ponder writing a prescription for hope, I would suggest that healthcare in today's world is a little too disconnected an industry to offer that sense of connection. That is the fundamental piece of hope. But at the clinics, we live life a little differently. With our vulnerable patients, connection is our primary offering. More than the doctor visit or the prescription, it's that connection. Because we know that hope changes health, changes circumstances, changes one's sense of agency, and changes lives. So I'm going to leave you with one story about the power and resiliency of hope. One you may recognize, Miss Susan. When Jimmy came to us, he was severely depressed, had several chronic medical conditions, but could not make eye contact and would not speak above a whisper. He turned to us as his last resort for improving his health and life, but he was not hopeful about it. He didn't come to us with any sense of hope. He was resigned, depressed, and really going through the motions, but somebody had told him he had to come. And because he was so beaten down by life, he was someone who responded to any challenge with anger and belligerence, raised voice, heated. It's the only time he raised his, he spoke above a whisper. And for a time after he came to us, life seemed to get worse for him. He had an accident on his bike, broke his arm, lost his job, and almost lost his rented trailer. But when things got worse, he found that he had a team of caring supporters for the first time in many decades. After he lost his job, he supported himself by collecting cans along the roadside, those that people throw out. And as support, other patients began bringing their cans in to the clinics to give to Jimmy. To be that sense of caring connection. Well, and then the staff did too, because we try to be that too. Thanks to the good coaching from some of his team, he began to understand the impact that poverty has on one's health. And one day, he approached his health advocate and asked, this is the man who doesn't speak above a whisper, but asked for a venue to tell people who matter that poverty kills. When we asked if he'd be willing to go to a community meeting of 150 plus community leaders to talk about the health of Henderson County. He not only said yes, he talked five of his peers into coming too. And thanks to Jimmy, Henderson County is the only one in the West that has what's known as a social determinant in our health assessment. And it really is his voice that got it there. So that we have in our health assessment a priority to safe and affordable housing. It's a health issue for Henderson County. From no voice or a whisper to telling our community leaders what matters to him. And then a few weeks ago, I was sitting in my office and I heard someone standing down the hallway on the phone in what was clearly a difficult conversation. I noted, I remember thinking, impressed. They advocated for themselves calmly but firmly. They stated what they wanted. They identified and affirmed personal boundaries. And they negotiated very well with the other party for resolution. There was no anger or rancor or belligerence in the exchange. So I was struck by how well this situation was handled, and I watched with curiosity as they passed my office door to go back into the group room. And I was shocked that it was Jimmy. That it was a model of how to handle one of those difficult conversations. He'd gone from belligerent and yelling to like a lesson I would teach my daughter. Hope gave him a voice, a clear sense of self-agency, health improvements, certainly. It enabled him to keep his house, and it changed his life. Resilient hope. For Jimmy, the key to his resilient hope is connection. Is that caring connection, which is 60% of what matters, which is fundamental to how we walk through the world. Like we in religious community have known for millennia, and science has recently discovered, we need one another. We are stronger and more hopeful together. We are resiliently hopeful because we have each other. This day and all days. Blessed be.